Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.
Everyone, welcome to our first podcast, Responding with Hope. We are excited to have our first guest, Rebecca Morgan, who is the director of the Department of Social Services in Middlesex County. And we're excited to have you. We appreciate your time. So start out by telling us a little bit about your background and what you do.
Sure. Yeah. So I started working for the social services system back in 2003. And my first assignment as a newly minted social worker was foster care. And I actually was working on my master's degree in counseling, and I had always wanted to be a counselor. But shortly after getting my job at social services, I realized that foster care was my passion. And I finished my master's and thought, oh, you know, I'll do this foster care thing for a few years and then I'll go be a counselor like I wanted to be. And it just didn't work out that way. I was hooked. And so finished the master's degree, but stayed with social services. And I worked at a small rural agency. And then I went to a larger agency. And then I came back to a smaller agency here in Middlesex County, and I've been here since 2010.
Wow. Wow. And 2010 seems like it was last week for some of us, but that was 10 years
right.
ago. Oh, amazing.
I know. And sometimes I'm just staggered to realize how long I've actually been here. It doesn't feel like it. This job moves so quickly, and there are always changes and new things to learn and cases. And so 10 years has really felt like 6 months.
Wow, that's awesome. Public service is definitely a calling. So, I mean, we've kind of answered the question on how you ended up in social services. That's an amazing story. Over the years, your department and Avalon, we've worked pretty closely together. Let's talk about your role with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. You know, our studies show that domestic violence and sexual assault are found in every economic and social strata, racial and ethnic group. On the local level, is that kind of what you see?
Well, social services has a sort of storied reputation in most communities. Most of our client population are lower income folks. And I think that middle and upper class citizens may think, oh, social services is for quote unquote, you know, poor people. We're not, we're here to serve everyone. But sometimes I think that those who maybe make a little bit more money or in professional positions or have that middle-class lifestyle are really in even more embarrassed to reach out. I think everyone's embarrassed when they have to seek services, especially if they are a victim. But I think maybe in a small town where everyone knows each other, it's difficult when something like this happens that's so personal, so private, and thinking about reaching out to a public agency who traditionally is known, let's just be honest, for giving out SNAP benefits, is intimidating. And they don't always know that, hey, yes, we do give out SNAP benefits, but we also do this whole other conglomeration of services. And so I think that a lot of times we might miss those cases. And just as I was kind of thinking through, we had a case recently with an older victim of domestic violence, and this particular incident had been going on for years, 10 plus years. And she was very, very hesitant to reach out to anyone for help. And she was extremely embarrassed and blamed herself, which is of course normal. And we happened to unfortunately get it to the point where something serious had happened and we were contacted by law enforcement. So I think sometimes middle and upper class cases sometimes have to get really extreme before we even know about it. Some of our other clients, we serve them through other programs. We're familiar with their lives. They talk to us, but we don't have that relationship with sort of the upper classes. In terms of race and ethnicity, I think we do have an Hispanic population here in Middlesex, and the language barrier, although we have bilingual staff, the language barrier and the culture is something that I don't feel like, again, until law enforcement calls us when something has actually happened, we don't have the same prevention opportunities that we do for many of our other clients.
I think we would say we see the same thing on our end, and it's a shame, sort of a stigma that comes along with the topic. And I think we're working, and you guys are both working, to kind of eliminate that stigma that goes across and let everybody know that services are available for everyone. And I second your concern with the language barriers, because we do struggle with that. And I think that's kind of across the board. So, and you know, we've talked about this before, but domestic violence is not only a physical assault of behavior, but it includes a wide array of behaviors. And that's a way for abusers to establish control. And I think it's common misconception on domestic violence, and we're working, and you guys are working to sort of get rid of that. But I feel like the general population doesn't understand that. And can you talk to me a little bit about those stigmas? And do you find that survivors are kind of unaware that they've been abused if they don't have those visible bruises?
Oh, absolutely. And the clearest example is certainly an economic one. And, you know, again, had a case a few weeks ago. The client, this broke my heart. I was the backup supervisor, so it was an on-call situation. I get to do some casework still in those types of cases. And just asking general questions about support systems. And she did have family, but they weren't close by. And I said, well, what about friends? And she looked down and bowed her head, and she said, I don't have any friends. And it really struck me that my goodness, this her partner had isolated her to the point of, you know, she was in a rural locality with no transportation, with two children, very little support system, no job. And so I thought the only person that she probably sees face to face is him every day. And he worked. So, I mean, he controlled the finances, the money. He controlled her housing. And so his name was on the lease, not hers and his. And so every aspect of her life is controlled. And I don't think she saw herself as a victim. I did. And although the abuse wasn't necessarily always physical, he had isolated her to the point where she stopped being able to cope on a day-to-day basis and went into a deep depression and started having anxiety. And of course, then it began affecting their children. And so no, I think that some of these situations build up over time, and men or women fall into them. And if I were to just start off my conversation with them, "So are you a victim?" The answer would be, "No, of course I'm not. I'm here of my own free will." But then you start unpacking that and asking these questions, and it's heartbreaking to kind of watch the realization dawn on them too. So,
yeah, and I think we, from Avalon's standpoint, talk to a lot of survivors, and we show them the power and control wheel. And they'll say, "No, well, you know, it just is recently that this has started. He just hit me this week." But when you sit down and you explain that power control wheel, and the realization, like you brought up, on their face, where this actually started years ago, and it built up to this, it escalated to this, it's very disheartening to see that look on their face and that realization that, you're right, this started a long time ago, but it was so slow. And it was just little things here and there that compiled and escalated to the situation that they're in. It's very disheartening. But you did mention children, so I want to touch on that. And we talked about this before too. Domestic violence not only victimizes women and men, but it substantially affects their children. And we call it secondary trauma. Can you tell us about the effects and the behaviors that you see in children specifically?
Oh, absolutely. So a lot of kids, especially the ones that are not yet in the public school system, and I know we'll be talking about COVID and its impact upon our system in a few minutes, but oftentimes no one knows what the manifestations are of domestic violence until children get to school and start talking about it with their friends, their teachers, the school nurse. And sometimes that's how we become aware of what's maybe going on in the household. And that can be expressed in various ways. So kids, they might just tell a trusted school counselor or teacher about it. But more often, it's not so straightforward. It'll be a behavior. It'll be lashing out at other students. It might be emotional imbalance, where a child can't maintain his or herself throughout the day. And it's hard to really, until we get to know that child really well, it's hard to know where that behavior is manifesting until we are able to sort of begin asking the questions and opening the conversation. And to do that with a five-year-old obviously is a challenge. But so it can be behavioral, it can be emotional. It can also be that the child doesn't understand how to interact with others, because in domestic violence situations, often it's not just the victim per se who is isolated. It's often the entire family. And so a lot of these kids don't have that experience of social interaction with other kids. And it's really evident when they get to school and don't know how to talk to other kids or adults. So those are just a few of the ways. And I'm just using an example of, you know, a five-year-old, say, that just, you know, gets to school, and a lot of times that's when we'll get the call.
Yeah, and it's, I'm sure, takes a toll on you guys emotionally when you get those phone calls. I know from our side and our counselors as well. And moving forward a little bit, what services do you guys offer that can help these families that are dealing with this when you finally get involved?
So we have various funding streams, including federal, state, and local funding that can provide counseling, whether that be family counseling. We can also refer for in-home counseling. And we also offer parenting classes. And we typically contract with outside providers for those. We do have access to a really great in-home parenting class.
Oh, great.
And a lot of times we'll make the referral for that. We also
of course, refer to Avalon for supports, for support groups and various services that are related to domestic violence. And a lot of times, yes, services are extremely important, but sometimes it's just getting back to basics and helping with housing, helping with other forms of the basics, transportation, housing, job search, education, making referrals to get someone the training that they need to find a stable job. And we really try and I think the mindset when we get a case like this, especially if it's new to us, I think one of the mistakes our system makes sometimes is overwhelming families with a plethora of things, and we come in and we try and fix it. And so what I've tried to learn over the years and in part to my staff, we've got to start small. So definitely counseling of some kind, yes. But let's not try and throw, you know, all of these changes onto this family at one time, and let's try and meet them with where they are and listen to what is important to them. And sometimes that's not always what we think is important in terms of maybe getting a job. Maybe that person needs to work on reestablishing a friendship or a relationship, or maybe that person just needs 6 months to really focus on counseling before he or she takes that next step to start building their life back. So, but yeah, we've got lots of services. That said, we do try and tailor them to individual situations.
So important. And I love what you said about meeting them where they are, because that's one of our counselor, Juanita Graham's famous saying. She said, you know, we've got to meet them where they are. And that's also, I feel like, a form of empowerment. It's really easy for us to come in and say, you need this, this, and this to get your life together. But if that's not where they are at that moment, you are acting as, for so long, these guys have been abused and had somebody else hold the power. And if you have to be careful, even though our intentions are to help them and good intentions, to not become another source of control and telling them what they need to do. It has to be her or his decision. And so I think it's important that they understand the services that you guys and Avalon Center offer, and that we're here when you need us and when you're ready. And then this is the step in the right direction. But I agree with you, and I love that you're right. We often grow into overkill, and we want to help, and we have all of these services at our disposal, and we dive right in. And I feel like that can be, as you said, overwhelming for someone. And at that point, it's just easier maybe to go back to the situation that they were comfortable with, because this is another situation that leaves their comfort zone. So I appreciate that view on it. And we can kind of switch gears a little bit as far as sexual violence. It's a topic that a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about, but do you guys have any services that you can offer victims of sexual assault? I think we've discussed it over the years. Sexual assault is not glamored by television. It's not what you see on television. Sexual assault is very different. It's in most of the cases we see, it's a family member, or it's a spouse, or it's unfortunate. It's not the woman running in the park and getting kidnapped by a complete stranger and raped. A lot of times this is very personal for people. So I wanted to touch on that with you and see what services you had.
Sure. So we do offer services for children under the age of 18 who have been sexually assaulted. And we also offer services for those over the age of 60 or who are disabled in our Adult Protective Services program. But one gap that really exists in our system, both for sexual assault and domestic violence in general, is that technically though that segment does not meet, if they're not disabled, not an older adult, not a child, they don't meet criteria for air services. Of course, we will help them, but most often we don't open a case. It's a referral. And so I think that's a huge gap in our social services structure here in Virginia that I, for one, would like domestic violence and sexual assault to be just as elevated as some of our other forms of abuse across age groups and gender and race. But that said, we have a lot of different services. And one of the services I think that often goes kind of gets missed when thinking about social services, very important with all victims to get a forensic exam, obviously completed by a medical professional. But the second part to that is getting that forensic interview completed and getting that experience documented as quickly as possible. Here in Middlesex, we are about an hour to an hour and a half away from the closest forensic interview center. So there's one at VCU, and then there's one at CHKD. Both of those cater to children, not adults. So what we've done is trained our staff in forensic interviewing. And we do the interviews ourselves. And even if the alleged the victim does not necessarily meet the criteria for one of our cases, we do have an agreement with our local law enforcement that we will conduct the forensic interview if they request it. And so I think that is something that Middlesex County offers to the community that may not be available in other rural communities. And I think too that doing those interviews also, even if it's not a case that we necessarily develop, it still gives us an introduction to that family. And so at least they know we're a safe place. They've met the forensic interviewer. They've met our staff. And even in 6 months, if they need help with something, I feel like it, at least they know we're here to help them. Yeah.
That's interesting. And I know Middlesex is famous for going above and beyond and doing what they need to do. And you have your own unique challenges for being, and as you touched on that, rural community, I think has its own, and transportation probably a big chunk of that is getting them to where they need to go. So I really appreciate that. And we talked about all of these issues. Are you seeing any particular impact as far as COVID goes in the families that you work with?
So unfortunately, yes, we have seen over a 50% decrease in the number of Child Protective Services reports since March. They have started increasing, but we are so concerned about the situations that we're missing just because these kids are not around others, trusted adults at school, etc. The reports that we have received have pretty much 100% been from law enforcement. And whenever we receive a report from them, typically it's serious. And so we have had injuries to children. We have had an increase in our sexual abuse reports. And we have had kids, I think, that maybe had time at home to think about some things that had happened in their lives and have disclosed to their parents about incidents that may have happened 2 or 3 years ago. So while there has been a decrease in the number of calls that we have received, the calls that we have received have been very serious. There's a lot of pressure on everyone right now, whether it be economic or health related or social isolation related. And I think substance abuse, those that were perhaps struggling through recovery from those issues, I think COVID has just added a layer that has made it even more difficult for recovery. We've seen an increase in domestic violence related to substance misuse and abuse. So yeah, COVID has been, I hate to say this because now it's a cliche and it's in the media, but COVID has put a spotlight on domestic violence, sexual assault, isolation, and it's really been a game changer for our system.
And I share your concern. And I think we all do. And my fear, and I know it's yours as well, is that we are just tapping the surface on some of the things that are being done. And when we say behind closed doors, what happens? And unfortunately, the past 6 or 8 months, behind closed doors means something new. And it, you know, safer at home, yes, but not for some. They are not safer at home. And I think we have this fear, and it keeps me up at night knowing that there are issues that have not even come to surface yet. And like you said, without intervention have escalated to the point where more services are needed. And I think we all are that silent fear that's kind of looming over us that we're hoping we're wrong about, but the fear that we're not. And I think, you know, you guys have been super busy, but let's talk about some of those fears that people have regarding DSS. And some people, let's just talk about it, erroneously think that you guys are there to take their children. And I think that's a misconception, and I know I can tell by your face you're itching to talk about that. So let's dive into that a little bit.
Yeah. So one thing I always do when I talk to someone who knows nothing about social services is the two sort of mantras that I say. Number one. We do not just give out money and SNAP benefits to anyone who needs them. Most of our clients, the majority of our clients, over 75% of our clients work, and they work very hard. And the economic circumstances that led to why they need help are complicated, and it's not always a clear-cut answer is to why, you know, I live a middle-class lifestyle, but my, you know, client may have had things happen in his or her life that led them to where they are now. So that's number one. And number two is, no, we do not want to remove children. That is the last thing we ever want to do. And people still ask me, even in 2020, you make money when you remove children. We absolutely do not make money when we remove children, and we do not seek to remove children. Our main mission is to keep families together, and we do whatever we can to make that happen. We just had a situation, in fact, and this did go a little out of bounds, but it just happened, so it's fresh on the mind. So had a situation where two boys could no longer safely remain in their household. And so we went to a family member and said, please, you know, can you take these kids? And of course she instantly said, yes, I will. But I have a trip planned that's been planned and paid for, and too late for them to go with her. So we ended up connecting the kids with their older sibling, and went above and beyond to try and make it work for those 2 weeks that that we needed. And that meant finding an appropriate place for all three of them to stay. And that meant paying for their food, and that meant thinking about how to take care of these kids. But that prevented a foster care placement, it prevented a removal, and it also kept the mother part of the plan, part of the solution. And so she had a hand in identifying who can help my kids right now when I can't. And so even if a child may not be safe at home, we are always trying to find relatives, trying to find friends, neighbors, teachers, whoever has a connection to this child to prevent that removal. Foster care is, it's been well documented to lead to poor outcomes for children when they become adults. And so if you do a survey at a prison or a jail, high percentages of those folks have been in foster care. It leads to homelessness, it leads to domestic violence, and it leads to that re-victimization later in life. And so we do everything we can to avoid foster care. It is not an optimal outcome. Now that said, when we do have to place children in foster care, the families that we work with who foster our kids are extraordinary. And I feel like we have done as a system a better job in the past, 15 plus years that I've been around in making sure that foster families are better supported, receive better training, and that we assess them in a way that, because the misnomer about foster families is, of course, that they're only in it for the money. Well, the peanuts that our foster families receive for caring for a kid are, I'd love to see someone try and profit from it. So, those are two subjects, two sort of mantras that I always talk about and that I'm pretty passionate about. And while we might not be able to save the world or save every kid, save every family, I do wish that society saw our role as one of strength instead of one of last resort.
Right. And I agree with you 100%. We appreciate what you guys do so much. It's especially in where you are in those rural counties that don't have a lot of the resources. I mean, that some of the urban cities do, but you guys, especially, you just go above and beyond, and we appreciate you more than you know. And I think part of the reason behind this podcast is let's talk about those things and let's bring to the forefront the value that you add to the community. And we would just really appreciate you. As kind of moving forward, we talked about this, really, I was going to talk to you about the misconceptions that sort of hinder people from coming and talking to you. And we sort of went out of order, but I wanted to keep the topic and smoothly going. But there are a lot of misconceptions that people have about DSS. And so anything that you would add to that is just to have, it's specifically middle class America, and let them come and talk to you and get services that they need.
Absolutely.
And do you guys ever see cases involving stalking?
Yeah, so we do, and a lot of it these days is internet stalking. It's social media. It's texting, and we have a really big challenge. 10, 15 years ago, when we helped someone get a protective order, we had to worry about phone calls, and we had to help that person change their phone number, and we might help that person move. But today we have to worry about, okay, you know, telling, especially someone who might be part of the younger generation, oh, you really shouldn't be on social media anymore, because that's a way that your stalker might find you, is really difficult. And the text messages and the bringing in of the third parties, and, oh, well, it wasn't me who sent the text message. It was her friend who sent it. Yeah, but you wrote it. And so the intricacies of trying to tease through all of that and then present it to our court system, it's really a challenge. And but I think stalking, we talked earlier about the economic control and folks not really thinking they're a victim. And I think stalking in many ways is very similar, because someone might say, oh, well, he just, you know, sends really inappropriate texts to me and I just delete them. Well, we look and, you know, it's 50 texts a day, and it's, you know, he's communicating with your family and your friends and your employers and showing up at your job. And so I think that is one that can also kind of creep up on victims, and they don't consider themselves victims and they don't consider themselves being stalked, but yeah, we see it a lot. And substance misuse obviously is a huge factor in that. So most of what we see is relationship stalking. And it's not stranger. It's not strangers doing the stalking. It's, you know, former partners and family members. Sometimes.
I imagine a lot of your job would be educating them on what stalking is.
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, back to COVID and school starting, and at the beginning, we talked about the kids starting school today, and then of course you have the high unemployment. Are there particular services or resources that you can provide during this time that maybe people don't know about, and use this opportunity to let them know?
Sure. So we are very lucky to have a wonderful partnership with our local food pantry, Hands Across Middlesex, which is located at the Cryer Center on Route 33. And they provide funding to us each quarter to help with needs of the community. It's very broad, and that's for anyone. There are some income guidelines, but right now with COVID, we understand that you may have been out of work for 3 months, and or your hours may have been reduced, and so we're being very flexible with that. We also have a partnership with local church, Zohar Baptist Church, that provides funding to us for needs in the community. A couple of other organizations, local organizations, the River County's Community Foundation, which is the community foundation for Lancaster, Northumberland, and Middlesex, provides funding for us and gave us funding specifically related to COVID back in April. And so that has really, really helped. In addition to that, each locality received CARES Act federal funding, and Middlesex County, which is really progressive for a small county, I'm proud of us, Middlesex County designated some of that funding for food insecurity and for housing. And so if someone is struggling with rent or another need that's directly related to COVID, we can assist. And we also, the county formed a partnership with Bay Aging, and they started a dinner delivery program for vulnerable adults. And it's really a neat program because they partnered with local restaurants who are struggling right now. And so these local restaurants are providing the meals, and then Bay Aging is delivering, using volunteers, delivering the meals two nights a week, and the CARES Act is funding that. In addition, Bay Aging is also coordinating for AIR Community the rent and mortgage program, which is the RMRP program, and that's a program that's a statewide program, and Bay Aging is coordinating it for our community. And so that can help with rent or mortgage for those struggling right now due to COVID. So COVID, I think, if there is a silver lining, I try to find it somewhere, but I think it is that local organizations, state organizations, federal, really understood the need and the needs that we were going to have. And I can't tell you in this community how many phone calls that I received. What can I do? What can we do? Whether it be money or time or donations. And so I think in some ways it has brought the community together. And but there again, there's that stigma. And so I worry about the folks who don't want to make the phone call to us. So that's why it's nice to have those partnerships with local churches. It's a little bit less intimidating to call your church for help, I hope. So, but yeah, those, I could go on, and I'm probably missing some of the resources right now that we have for COVID, but.
And I think part of this podcast called Responding in Hope, with Hope, is that these communities, and like you said, if there is a silver lining to COVID, we have learned to rely on each other, and we are coming together, and the resources that your county has for the community, and that sense of community in the small town is just, it's fabulous. If there's anything coming out of this that's good, and I think the challenge is letting people know that it's okay. We're all here together. We're all in this together. And I hate saying that too, because I feel like that's become a cliche, that we're all in this together, but we are. And you know, where you can help others, you help them. And when you need help, you get help, and get yourself back up on your feet so that you too can be the one that's doing the helping. And I think that's a big challenge that we're facing. We're so glad that these, especially, you're right, it's easier to go to your church and get help than it would be to walk into social services and ask for help. So we as Avalon cannot respond without the help of our community and our community partnerships. And I know you guys are this exact same way. And while we're on the subject of the rural community, what kind of specific challenges have you guys seen that you would face in a rural community versus a more urban setting?
So definitely it's the laundry list of rural life. No public, well, we have Bay Transit, but no fixed route public transportation, or on-demand public transportation. And really, to do anything here, even to get to the grocery store, is very few communities that are walkable to get to a grocery store. And I see on the news and in this, you know, this Instacart craze that is going on right now, and that is just not something available here. And but again, our local food bank, Hands Across Middlesex, has stepped up, and they will actually deliver. And our school system is delivering meals to those who can't get them. Isolation, social isolation. I can't say enough how and how many times I have even said to my staff and how we have all had this discussion about how we are so lucky to have, well, first of all, to have a job right now, but second of all, to have a job where we feel like we're contributing. And I'm not quite sure what I personally would have done had I not had this job during COVID. And I just worry about those who are pretty much at home, and the depression, the mental health outcome to this era is just going to be astounding, I think, in the next few years. And just services in general. You mentioned services earlier in terms of those just kind of being readily available sometimes in urban areas. And I think we try and get as creative as we can. Middlesex is close enough sometimes that we can make it work. So we're just close enough to Richmond, and we're just, some parts of Middlesex are just close enough to Newport News and Hampton that we can make it work and have our clients get access to those services. But I think that, you know, COVID has just made things just that much more difficult. And there's also a lot of fear in Middlesex. Air population is hovering right about 30% of 65 and over. And so some of our clients have actually stopped having those in-home services that they normally get because they're afraid. They certainly don't want to get COVID. And so that's been a challenge.
And so while, you know, and kind of closing up and everything, what is the role of CPS and APS? So we're talking, as we talk about those elders. And
yeah, so great question. So Child Protective Services, we have several categories of abuse. The most obvious, physical abuse, sexual abuse. But we also have what's called physical neglect. And that could be that a parent leaves a child unattended and the child doesn't have the resources or capability to understand how to contact help if they need it. We also have mental or emotional abuse categories. And in adult protective services, what we're finding, most of the adult protective services cases that we receive are for self-neglect. And so for folks who have gotten to a point where they can no longer take care of themselves, and maybe they can't take care of their home, but they haven't made a plan for how to navigate through their aging years. But what's really on the rise, especially here in Middlesex, is financial exploitation. At times, our older adults are victimized by those who take advantage of some beginning stages of dementia, perhaps, or just isolation in general. Older adults might see this new person in their life as a friend, but really this person is just out to perhaps financially exploit them. And of course, we have physical abuse and sexual assault, unfortunately, with our adult protective services population as well.
You guys, thank you. Thank you so much for all that you do. And Rebecca, I appreciate your time with us today. It was very enlightening, and you definitely educated me on things that I didn't know. And I'm happy to put this podcast out, and hopefully, even if we help one person come forward, I think we've done, you know, it's been worth it. And I, like I said, I appreciate you guys so much. Again, this is Rebecca Morgan with the Department of Social Services in Middlesex, and I appreciate you.
Great. We appreciate Avalon.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.